From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For the past 15 years, Tony Buba has made documentary films about his hometown of Braddock, Pennsylvania. The films chronicle both the economic decline of this steel town and the fantasies of some of Buba's favorite oddballs who live there. On today's Fresh Air, the offbeat films of Tony Buba. Also today, the trade-offs between domestic security and personal growth with novelist Hilma Wolitzer. Her latest novel follows a married couple trying to salvage their marriage on the eve of their silver anniversary. And we have reviews of new rock albums from Tin Machine and Royal Crescent Mob, and of Robin Williams' new movie, Dead Poets Society. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When celebrated German film director Werner Herzog was in Pittsburgh several years ago, he chose to watch the documentaries of local filmmaker Tony Buba. A sign of Herzog's approval was his advice to Buba, steal if necessary to keep making your movies. But with the help of a Guggenheim Fellowship and NEA and Rockefeller Foundation grants, Buba hasn't had to resort to that. For more than 15 years, Tony Buba has been making movies that chronicle the decline of his hometown, Braddock, Pennsylvania. It's a former steel town just outside of Pittsburgh. When the mills shut down, the population dropped and unemployment soared. Many of the stores and churches and all of the movie theaters closed. Buba's movies have an offbeat sense of humor. For instance, his film J. Roy, New and Used Furniture, was about the opening of a new store by a Braddock businessman. Jimmy Roy had already gone broke in business 11 times, but he insisted he grew more confident with each failure and was passing on that confidence in his pep talks. Buba's latest film, Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl fantasy, is part documentary about Braddock, part autobiography about Buba's life as a filmmaker, and part fantasy. The film follows Buba as he makes a documentary on a plant closing while getting harassed by a former numbers runner named Sweet Sal, who was the subject of one of Buba's earlier films. In this scene, Buba describes one of the dilemmas he faced while making this low-budget film.
In this part of the film, Steve Pellegrino plays Jumping Jack Flash on the accordion, but you won't get to hear him play. I called about acquiring the rights to the song, but they wanted $15,000 for it. I told them, I don't want Mick Jagger to come to Braddock to sing it. I have a friend who plays it on the accordion. They still wanted $15,000. $15,000 is three times the per capita income of a Braddock resident. I didn't think it would be a politically correct move to pay that kind of money for a song. In fact, it's crazy. This isn't the Hollywood feature we're making here. I know some of you are going to think this sounds real Catholic, but when I die and get to heaven, what if, instead of St. Peter being at the gate, it's Sacco and Vanzetti? And they say to me, you paid $15,000 for a song instead of spending that money for political organizing? I wouldn't get in.
Well, Tony Buba, with Sacco and Vanzetti manning the gates of heaven, let's explore this theme of guilt a little bit further. Has this film, more than other films, brought out your fears of abandoning your politics?
Yes, it has. I mean, my politics sort of, they go back and forth to begin with, let alone and the fear of abandoning them altogether always comes up. I mean, I wouldn't know what I would do if I was really offered a contract from somewhere or a film to direct that didn't have my political beliefs in them. Would I actually take the job or not? I mean, this is, you know, getting older, I need money for retirement. What would I do? And that does bother me.
Let me explore another aspect of your guilt. You say in the film that your success seems to be dependent on the failure of others, and that your fame and your exposure on TV seems to be directly proportionate to the number of layoffs in Braddock, which I thought was a pretty funny way of looking at it. Does that seriously bother you?
It bothers me about almost all documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
I brought it out specifically to my case, but I think for anybody doing documentary work, I mean, the people whose films get distributed the most are people doing films on AIDS right now. Anytime there seems to be a crisis, they're there with the cameras. It's a friend of mine in California, Larry Dressick, called it left-wing ambulance chasing, where you're always there at the scene, you film it, then the crew disappears. And what happens 4 or 5 years later? Nobody knows. Has the problem been solved, or is it just continuing, and there's no continuing documentation on it because it's no longer a hot issue? And people just tend to chase different issues because that's where the grant money is. mean, some people actually study the Washington Post to find out what rules are going through, what laws are, or funding is going through Congress, and then making the film that, for that way.
How about this? Do you have guilt that the film is personal and funny?
No, that never bothered me being personal and funny. That that type of humor that I deal with comes from working a lot in factories when I was younger. I didn't start college until I was 25, so I spent the first 7 years working either in delivering plumbing supplies and working in factories. And that the type of humor that I do is what maintains the sanity on the factory floor while you're working on the assembly line. The humor is just really, it borders on being surreal.
Well, Lightning Over Braddock is really difficult to describe in the sense that it's several films in one. It's in part a film about you making a documentary about a plant shutdown in Braddock, and it's in part a fantasy based on a character from the town named Sal, who you'd made a documentary about before. And Sal is used to be a numbers runner and something of a con man, I take it.
Right, yeah. Sal, I've known Sal almost all my life since I was about 12, 13 years old. Actually, my family's even known him longer. He had been like an intern, like an apprentice at my grandfather's shoemaker shop when he was a kid, and that never really worked out. Then I got to meet Sal when I was about 13 years old, 12 or 13. He had a little numbers joint on the avenue, and my cousin worked for him, so I used to go there and play the number and that kind of stuff. And he was one of the older guys that always hung on a corner. You know, the type that's around 30 years old and everybody else is 15. He has the Cadillac and just sort of stands on the corner with the Stetson shoes and the alligator belts and that type of dress. Yeah, so I've known Sal a long time. And what happened over the years was that I was not really ever that good of friends with him, but I would help him out with different favors at different times. Then I went away to school and I hadn't seen him for a long time. I came back and I started doing these documentaries, and I did one on J. Roy. And after I did the one on Jimmy Roy and it got mentioned in the paper and everything, he was really pestering me about doing a documentary on him. He said his life was a lot more interesting than J. Roy's, so I eventually made one on him.
Let's get back to your new movie. Your new movie, again, is in part a documentary about you making a documentary on a steel shutdown, and it's a part about Sal, about Sal not getting out of your life after you made that documentary about him, about Sal insisting that he's responsible for any success you've achieved, that he's the real star, and that you're somehow ending up with all the credit.
Yeah, that what happened with that idea was that it started. He did start pestering me after a while. It's like I had gotten him a job with George Romero on a film called Night Riders, with a security guard, and he actually had a little bit part in that. And what happened? He's living with his brother, and they got into an argument, so he had moved out of his brother's house, and he was sort of depressed. And I said, "Well," and he was calling me all the time, and I was helping him get on Social Security disability. He's a real bad diabetic. And he couldn't work, so we started talking. I said, well, let's make a new film. I said, it'd be a story of me and you, a story of a documentary film. He makes a film on this person now, can't get this person out of his life. And that was where the idea came from. And he said, sure, okay. So we started shooting, and we shot one summer about, we shot a fantasy where he plays Gandhi, and we shot stuff in his room where he calls me up on the telephone all the time. And that was sort of it for about a year. Then I got a grant from the NEA, and I continued working on it. Then the whole film just kept changing as I kept working on it.
So was the way you depicted Sal in this movie of being this real pest who won't leave you alone and who really believes he's responsible for your success, was that part real at all?
Yeah, it's half real. I mean, it's exaggerated for the film, but it's fairly real. Yeah, he does believe that he's responsible for my success. And sometimes I don't know. I mean, when you're a documentary filmmaker, who is responsible for your success? I mean, it's always, if you have a weak subject, your film is not going to go anywhere, so it's always depends on the subject you're filming, and so where what is the relationship between the two? I'm traveling around the country. I'm doing a radio show like this. I go to Seattle or go into Portugal and show these films. The people I'm filming, I mean, they're on, some are on welfare, some are unemployed. What is my responsibility to them? What is their relationship? What do I have owe to the community? What does the community owe me? Type of thing. And it's always going through my mind. I mean, if I moved out of Braddock, I don't know if I can make any more films about Braddock, because then I feel it is really exploiting the people I'm with.
I want to give a sense of what Sal is like. Now, the parts in which he calls you up and yells at you about how you've abandoned him and how he's really better than you are, those parts are too obscene to play.
Yeah, Sal has a way with a four-letter word. He could put so many different meanings into the use of it. It's almost like poetry. I mean, the way he uses the word, he expresses anger or like this, it doesn't matter. He uses the same word, and And he does a great job in using it to express himself, but I don't think we can put it on the air.
Well, there is a scene, however, in which his car breaks down, and he climbs up to the roof of the car to yell at God for abandoning him once again. And that part goes a lot easier on the obscenity. So let's hear that.
Hey, you! What are you doing to me? What are you doing to me? All you ever gave me was sickness, pain, and kept me busted from the day I was born. I've had it up to my eyeballs with you, so I'm gonna cut you loose. Understand? I'm cutting you. Kamish!
I think in Lightning Over Braddock you had a chance to fulfill a couple of weird fantasies of your own in the film inserts, that you use little film fantasies that you've created. One of them is of Sal. There's a segment of him as Gandhi driving into into Braddock in a convertible.
That came about for... One is that I knew he would look like Gandhi with the ball wig. And also, I try to do like a combination Gandhi-Kennedy assassination. And this another reason that came about is that they were both sort of heroes when I was growing up, thinking about then also becoming disillusioned with afterwards. So I was sort of poking fun at my own self for believing in, totally believing in these two people, then realizing their faults later.
Well, it's this very funny sequence, and you've got, like, the sitar music.
Right, that's a Steve Pellegrino. He called the music Third World Gumbo. He is Steve Pellegrino, who does Jumping Jack Flash in the film and plays the accordion player. He writes all the music for me.
So when you were filming Sal as Gandhi riding into town, you had spectators lining the streets. Were they... really just watching you film the shot, or ask them to be there?
No, what happened is what I did with the whole film to have crowd scenes, I'd go every time there was an event, and every year the Braddock Firemen's have a parade. So I wanted to get in front of the parade so I'd have more of a crowd, but they wouldn't let me. So I just, when the parade, the last fire truck went by, I just went in there with Gandhi, and we pulled up, and everybody was just, they didn't know what to do. And they were coming down the street, and finally where I had him shot. Some people thought he had a heart attack. These kids, they're looking at me on Gumby. So it was just, I just like playing around with that and having the people involved in it, not really knowing what's going on, but just sort of experimenting with what happens and going with it.
In the middle of this movie, actually toward the end, you say that Sal won't talk to you anymore. They dropped out of making the movie. Was that real?
Yeah, that was real. What happened, he actually dropped out twice. It was the second time that it was totally finished. There's a scene in the film where he's supposed to be in the restaurant talking to Jimmy Roy. And Jimmy Roy was supposed to tell Sal, you have to think positive, and that's the only way you're going to make it. Well, Sal didn't want to do the scene with Jimmy. He thought Jimmy would steal the scene from him. So we had a little bit of an argument there. Then I was having a microphone problem, and I was taping, and the woman was doing a test, and she was taping... Sal and Ernie talking, and Sal said something about being broke. Well, he says that a lot, and he actually said that down my house about 3 months earlier. So he came to the house, and I was just playing some sound, and he heard the sound was recorded at the restaurant, and he thought I recorded it in my home. So then he thought I was wired with a microphone at all times, and he wanted to frisk me. So we got into this big fight. We're out on the porch. He's he wants to frisk me. So I stripped down to my underwear. I said, there's no microphone. I'm starting using the four-letter words. I'm swearing at him. My mother's looking out the window. The neighbors are looking. We got into this big screaming match, and that was it. And I hadn't seen him for about 3 years, and I ran into him at the Braddock Post Office about a month ago. And we had a decent conversation, but that's been it.
Oh, gosh. Well, my guest is filmmaker Tony Buba, and he's made a long series of movies documenting his city, Braddock, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Pittsburgh. Most of these movies are documentaries about this small steel town, which has really been shut down with the decline of industry. His new film is called Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl Fantasy. How did you start documenting the shutting down of your town?
It started when I was in graduate school. I enrolled in a graduate film program at Ohio University. And at that time, I really didn't have much of a background. I didn't have any background in film. I went to a small state school in Pennsylvania called Edinburgh, and I got a degree in psychology, and I didn't know what to do. So I ended up, David Weinkauf, who taught there, so he said, why don't you go to film school. So I said, did that, and I got accepted. And I always tell the story because the head of the department was named Joe Anderson. He took anybody with a funny last name that year. He accepted Kathy Kodak, Tommy Tuttle, Tommy Tucker, and Tony Booba. He said he had to find out what a booba looked like. And that was his sole criteria for getting into school. It was, if your grades weren't too bad, he liked people older and from different backgrounds. And I went there, and the program was fairly laid back, and the emphasis was on doing personal work. And I happened to come home and saw, you know, how you're gone away for a while and you come back and see things deteriorate. And I did. The first film was on the closing of my grandfather's shoemaker shop. And they were getting rid of all the equipment. So I just happened to come back later on that spring, and Jimmy Roy was having a grand opening of a used furniture store. And I thought that idea bordered on being surreal, and I filmed that. And so I just went with it. And I got some recognition for doing that at local festivals, so I just kept with it.
Was that the key for you when this teacher suggested to you that you make personal films?
Yeah, that was, because I had, the emphasis at that time was experimental work. And most people who went to OU weren't interested in going to Hollywood. It was, you get your MFA and end up teaching at a university to do your own work. And I didn't have a strong art background, but I just, so they said, well, just work on what you, personal documentaries. And that was, that's what I started doing. And so, the films range anywhere from some are 3 minutes, some are 2 minutes. Some are on my family, some are on the community. They go from 2 minutes to an hour and a half.
I guess the emphasis on personal told you where to go also, that you didn't need to go someplace else to do a documentary. You could go home and shoot the people who you knew from your childhood and the streets that you grew up on and use that.
Yeah, it was, yeah, just, and the one teacher taught home movies as a genre. And so, that just really brought it all to light with me. And I went home, and I've been able, even though I live in Bragg, I've been able still to distance. You know, I live in the community and involved with people in the community, but still able to maintain a distance that I could look at things somewhat objectively.
I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is filmmaker Tony Booba, who has done a long series of documentaries, personal documentaries, chronicling people and things in his hometown of Braddock, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Pittsburgh, and it's a former steel town that's been kind of shutting down over the past few years. His new film is called Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl fantasy, and it's part documentary, part fantasy, part political, and part comedy. And we'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Filmmaker Tony Booba is my guest. Are there things that you've tried to avoid in your documentaries that you've seen in others and haven't liked?
Yeah, I try to avoid the sort of real humanist approach to documentaries where it's man against nature, man, noble creature, man wins out at the end. I've tried to avoid that. And in Lightning Over Braddock, I really wanted to avoid the whole thing of a laid-off steel worker, starts drinking, beats his wife and kids, and gets a divorce, almost getting ready to get divorced, finds another job, and everything works out well in the end. I mean, that type of approach to filmmaking I have a tough problem with. I have a tough problem with a lot of films that sort of fall into the real realistic approach of filmmaking is a natural style, which somehow to me never really works, where they try to do a real life situation and just does it to me just falls apart.
Yeah, you think there ends up being a lot of platitudes and cliches in that kind
yes,
of
that. I mean, it really. I mean, you look at a lot of stuff on Working People. That's outside of say the opening of a film that. Now, Paul Schrader did, Blue Collar, which was really, the opening of that film, the first like 10 minutes, it was incredible, the factory work and the music and the pounding, the beat. I mean, there's been very few films that really sort of capture the spirit of people that work for a living. I won't say, what drives me nuts is when people come into Pittsburgh and they say, or a film crew comes in, I'll say, well, these are real people here. I never, that expression always drives me crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like here because the people are real. I mean, what does that mean? These people are real. And people who live in Los Angeles, aren't the Chicanos and Asians who live in Los Angeles real? I mean, I don't know what they mean.
Did people in your family work in the steel mills?
Yeah, my father worked 40 years in the mill. He was a welder at the Edgar Thompson plant in Braddock. And And it's sort of amazing when you live in a meal community. I mean, every day you see that meal. You walk down the street and you see this giant structure in front of you. And I always found them quite beautiful, actually. And I'm really sad when they tear them down. I mean, I like to just see them be there and being even if they're abandoned, just for the architecture.
When you were young, did you assume you'd grow up and work in the mills like your father?
No. Three words of advice my father always gave me was, as soon as I got older, was never work in the mill, you know, never go to war, and move out of Braddock as soon as you can. The only thing I ever was successful at is I haven't moved out of Braddock and I haven't worked in the mill.
So, but you went to college really late when you were how old? Did you start
I was
college?
25 when I started college. Yeah, I had no intention. I was a really poor student in high school, and I was, yeah, it was in high school, sort of in the 1960s, you know, when I picked up one book by Camus, and so I started going into existentialism, and everything's going to be dead by the time I'm 21, the world's going to blow up, you know. So all of a sudden, I'm 21 years old, I'm still working in the factory, the world is still around, and next thing I know, I'm 24, and I'm still working on the factory floor going crazy. I don't know if anybody's worked on the assembly line, but sometimes there's nothing to do but daydream. You know, I must have played quarterback for Notre Dame and led them to national championships for 3 years in a row. And my daydreams started repeating themselves. I said, it's time to get out of here.
Now, over the years, you've been making documentary films. They're not what's totally supported you. It's hard to make a living making documentaries.
Right. I've been living... I teach part-time at the Pittsburgh Filmmakers. We offer classes there. I teach part-time at the Pittsburgh Filmmakers. And I was doing a lot of industrial video work. I do audio work on industrial videos, and that's all supporting myself. But I've been real fortunate the last 3 or 4 years. This year, I got a Rockefeller Fellowship, so I'm living off of that. And I had gotten a Guggenheim like 2 years before that. And the last 3 years, I've been actually supporting myself doing film work, my own films and these different fellowships.
Now, you've worked on a few of George Romero's horror films. You worked on Martin, which was a vampire film, and was it Dawn of the Dead?
Dawn of the Dead,
which
right.
is one of the, in the zombie yeah. series.
Right. Actually, it might be my biggest claim to fame. I'm in Dawn of the Dead. I get my arm ripped off in a blood pressure machine. I'm wearing a Mexican sombrero, and I'm one of the motorcycle raiders, and they jerk my arm out of the machine. I mean, I searched everywhere to find a sombrero because I knew the film would become a cult hit, so I thought if I could find the most outrageous costume, I could be on. People can spot me on camera a lot.
No, in addition to your cameo, you did sound?
I did audio on Dawn of the Dead, right.
Yeah. So you must have had to mic a lot of screams and moans and shrieks and chomping, because this is a film where the zombies are eating arms and legs and any other limb they can get their mouths on.
Right, that was, a lot of that sound was late. It was put in later with the chomping noises. Yeah, we got to record a lot of that.
You use some special effects in the new movie, in the fantasy sequences. Well, there's special effects blood for the Gandhi sequence. There's a Rambo sequence where you're shot.
Right.
And then there's a sequence where a car blows up.
Right.
You can't afford to do this on a meager independent documentary budget.
Well, you can if there's an, like I said, I keep mentioning the Pittsburgh Filmmakers, which is a real valuable organization to independents because we have classes there. And one of my students, Greg Funk, wanted to do special effects. I mean, this is what he does. He's getting really good at it. And he went to part of a resume reel. He says, well, can we blow up a car? I said, sure. So he went out and bought Sal's old Cadillac. It was a rusted down Cadillac. It wasn't running. And we blew it up. And he did all the blood and the different special effects. And like other people, like John Bick and Brady Lewis, people involved with the filmmakers, you know, they give me crew help. And there's some people I haven't mentioned, and they might get mad, but I guess Susan Howard. I mean, these people are around the filmmakers, and they volunteer the time. We take turns working on each other's projects. And if it wasn't for people like that, no way I'd get the film finished.
Once you directed a car blowing up, did it give you the urge to do more?
It sort of does, like getting a tattoo. You know, once you do one, you know, you want another one. I keep thinking, well, there's these Squirrel Hill tunnels in Pittsburgh. What if we had someone driving through the tunnels and placing someone's head through the railing, and the car comes back and knocks the head off? You know, and I have an idea now for which I'm trying to write of Phantom of the Blast Furnace, where it would be like a horror film where an unemployed steelworker is living in a blast furnace and ends up attacking corporate leaders. This is a script I'm starting to work on.
What happens when you show your movies to the people in Braddock who are in it? And I'm asking this because you have a really offbeat sense of humor. And also some of the people in the film do curse profusely.
Yeah,
and although it's about your town, I can imagine some people in the town being a little offended.
Yeah, it's a couple different reactions. One, the first time I ever showed them in Pittsburgh, Sal was there and Jimmy Roy was there. And after I got done showing the Sweet Sal film, Sal got up and started talking. That's not me up there. I was just acting that whole time. I don't really act like that. And it seemed like the film never ended because he just went into this whole monologue after the film. And Jimmy Roy got up on stage afterwards and started plugging his store and where they could buy different jewelry. People perceive themselves when they see themselves on the screen. I mean, they remove it from a distance. I've never – what I do in editing is that if I'm not comfortable at that time with what they're saying to make fun of what they've said on the spot, then I don't use it in the film because then I think it's being too exploitive. But if Jimmy would say something that it sounds real stupid, if I can't say, hey, Jimmy, that's dumb, you know, how can you even think that? If I can't say it to him then I won't use it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the criteria I go by.
You're staying in Braddock, at least for the time being.
Right.
Do you think that there are some people in Hollywood who really enjoy knowing that there's people like you staying in your hometown? Reassuring in it?
I don't know. There's lip service paid to that. But you also get, if you stay in your hometown, you also get categorized doing like regional cinema.
Right.
And sometimes that takes on the notion of doing folk art or something. It's not quite good enough to be New York or Los Angeles. And, you know, I find that real insulting.
So you feel you're patronized.
Yeah, you know, it's really fine regional cinema. You know, get out of here with that term. Right? You know, regional cinema. You go see some of the films that are out there. I mean, they're not that good. And I do feel patronized with that term. I mean, it is regional cinema in the sense that I'm from the area, but I don't want it. It's not as a folk art type of approach to it.
I remember John Waters, the filmmaker who's lived in Baltimore for so long, once saying that he felt like he'd never be able to leave because he'd made such a big deal about being in Baltimore that now he'd never be able to get out even if he wanted to leave. And Fran Lebowitz, it was the same way about stopping smoking. She'd made such a big thing about being a smoker. She'd never be able to stop. Do you ever feel that way about living in Braddock, that when you want to get out, that you might not be able to because you're so identified with it and such a part of your thing?
Yeah, I do. The other day we were thinking about it because my father, before they started working in the mill, they used to have a small farm in Braddock Hills, and they were farmers, and there's a little bit of land up there. So, boy, it'd be nice to build a house up here. But then if I build a house up here, then I'm living in Braddock Hills, which is only a half a mile away, but I'm no longer living in Braddock. Or I saw a teaching job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I said, well, you know, if I move there, but then I keep saying on these interviews that how much I'll be in Braddock and stay in Braddock. You know, I do feel... I don't know if I'm getting myself into a bind or not by saying I'll stay in Braddock. I haven't had a thought for a film that hasn't generated from Braddock ever. When I was finishing getting my degree, you had to do your oral interviews, and one of the instructors asked me, he said, well, do you think you can make a film outside of Braddock? I said, well, I don't think I ever had to. And so far, I haven't, but I don't know if I am sort of putting myself into this trap. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your movies. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Tony Buba's new film, Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl Fantasy, will be shown June 5th through 8th in Pittsburgh at the Fulton Theater. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with soul and gospel singer Mavis Staples. With her family, the Staples Singers, she sang hits such as I'll Take You There and Respect Yourself. Most of the songs on her new album, Time Waits for No One, were written and produced by Prince. I hope you can join us.
Pray on my child.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For years, Hilma Wolitzer concentrated more on cooking and cleaning than on writing. Now she's a successful novelist. Her latest novel, Silver, is about a middle-aged couple caught between domestic complacency and individual self-fulfillment. Coming up, Wolitzer discusses the conflicts in her characters' lives and her own. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dead Poets Society, starring Robin Williams and directed by Peter Weir, who made Witness. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums, the first by David Bowie's new band, Tin Machine, the second by the Dayton, Ohio group, Royal Crescent Mob. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. El Salvador's new president was sworn into office today. Alfredo Cristiani is a member of the right-wing Arena Party, some of whose members have been linked to political death squads. More from Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
When President Cristiani took the oath, hundreds of supporters chanted his name and artillery guns fired a salute. In his speech, he promised to hold a permanent dialogue with leftist rebels to end the war. But he offered no concessions to the rebels and indeed said he'd be much tougher than the last government in applying the law. In a party renowned for past links to violence, Cristiani is seen as a moderate. But in the last few weeks, Arena's right wing has been pushing for position in the government. Party founder, ex-Major Roberto Dabuisson, a name often linked to death squads, was given a standing ovation at the inauguration. Although he's not in the cabinet, hardliners will control the Interior Ministry and the Ministry of the Presidency, and Dabuisson's attorney will be the presidential private secretary. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Secretary of State James Baker acknowledged today that there were some difficult technical questions ahead in future U.S.-Soviet arms reduction talks. But at a news conference in London, he said the U.S. timetable, agreed to by NATO ministers, is not unrealistic. Baker said the president's success this week in Brussels reasserted U.S. leadership in the Western alliance.
It is important, I think, that an American president be seen to be leading the alliance. And I would respectfully submit that the president was seen actively and aggressively and effectively leading the NATO alliance during the course of this week.
In London tonight, President Bush reaffirmed what he called the special relationship between the United States and Britain. After a state dinner with Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, Bush spoke with reporters.
We, of course, have great respect for the Prime Minister, and the relationship with the UK is strong. And so I leave here feeling good about our bilateral relationship and very good about the alliance.
The president ends his week-long visit to Europe tomorrow. China's government tightened martial law restrictions today as thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators continued to occupy Beijing's central square. Details from the BBC's Tim Luard.
The latest restrictions on news gathering amount to a virtual ban on all coverage of the unrest. A local government spokesman told journalists there was to be no reporting of activities banned under martial law in Tiananmen Square, no interviews on such matters with Chinese citizens, and no reports on the enforcement of martial law by troops. The Peking Foreign Correspondents Club described the rules as a deplorable case of press censorship and harassment. The new clampdown suggests the authorities may want journalists off the streets in the event of the army entering the capital. An increasing number of military jeeps and trucks have been seen near the city center, and hundreds of helmeted soldiers were shown on Chinese television running in formation near the railway station less than a mile from Tiananmen Square.
Tim Luard in Beijing. House Speaker Jim Wright says he feels liberated following his resignation speech yesterday. The man expected to replace Wright, Washington Democrat Tom Foley, was widely praised today by fellow members as the right man to begin a healing process in the House. Foley said he believes there was an overwhelming desire among members of both parties for return to mutual respect and conciliation. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 13 points to close at 2493.20. Advances led declines 8-5 on a volume of 181 million shares, and the average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 15 cents as the market went up to 2493.20. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you watched the International Rock Awards on TV this week, then you saw David Bowie with his new band, Tin Machine. Rocker DeKen Tucker has a review of their debut album, as well as another debut album by a band he thinks is really worth listening to, Royal Crescent Mob. First, Tin Machine.
The first new collection of songs around these days is the one that's getting the most attention. Tin Machine, the new band that includes David Bowie, proves once again that in the latter part of his career, Bowie knows how to manipulate the media better than he makes music. Having suffered a couple of flop albums and a major flop concert tour, Bowie made a brilliant conceptual move. Rather than just slink off into the shadows the way so many apparently over-the-hill rockers do, he organized a group, used his fame to get it signed to a major label, and then started giving interviews saying he was just another guy in a completely democratic outfit, that he wasn't the leader, just a singer in a rock and roll band. Bowie says he wanted to make rougher, cruder, louder music than he's recorded in a while, and he's done that. Tin Machine also includes guitarist Reeves Gabrels and a rhythm section consisting of brothers Hunt and Tony Sales. Yes, baby boomers, the sons of Soupy Sales, and yes, punk rockers, the guys who used to back up Iggy Pop. Together, they've made some very dumb music. That's Crack City, written by Bowie. It's his long-awaited commentary on the drug problem and climaxes with this stirring quatrain, "And you, the master dealer, may death be on your brow, may razors slash your mainline, I'm calling you out right now." Imagine, called out by David Bowie. I think there must be some pretty petrified drug dealers prowling the streets today. Now we'll hear just a bit of Pretty Thing, Bowie's long-awaited attempt at writing a dirtier, euphemistic sex song than Madonna, who is mentioned by name. For those of you who missed it, that chorus was, "Oh, you pretty thing, shake your pretty thing, gimme that pretty thing." And boy, did it rock, huh? Whew. Looking for alternatives to this tripe? I have a recommendation, one that does not feature a lurking superstar and that achieves with ease the roughness that Tin Machine strives for so laboriously. All this plus a sense of humor. I'm talking about the Royal Crescent Mob, whose new album, called Spin the World, is raucous and exhilarating. This quartet seems able to write about anything that happens to them. As best I can figure out, for example, this song is about being rushed to the hospital after a drug overdose and having a religious conversion that doesn't last very long.
I was feeling bad, didn't have no girl. I would sit in my room with the TV on. I thought, good golly, I feel like dying. I got no insurance, sick as a dog. I might have passed away. I might have let it go. Well, I had a fever and my dreams, they got real weird.
That's the Royal Crescent Mob. In concert, this interracial band from Dayton, Ohio, plays covers of Rick James's Love Gun and the Ohio Players' Love Roller Coaster. In their own songs, you can hear influences ranging from Howlin' Wolf to the Swingin' Medallions' Double Shot of My Baby's Love. There's also music that is utterly original, such as the song I'm going to finish off this review with. It's called Tundra, and it's about chasing a loved one across an Arctic landscape, and it somehow manages to work in a little yodeling, too. Top this, Tin Machine.
Royal Crescent Mob from Spin the World. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket was the title of the first short story published by Hilma Wolitzer. Wolitzer was 35, raising two daughters and taking care of her suburban Long Island house when that story appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. She's written five novels since then, sticking with the themes of marriage and family life. Her latest novel, Silver, is a sequel to a 1977 novel, In the Flesh. Silver will be out in paperback this summer. The main characters are Paulie Flax and her husband, Howard. The story opens on the eve of their silver anniversary as their life together is about to change.
One night in August, understanding all at once why I'd been so sad, I decided to leave Howard. This was the real thing, not just the fireworks of battle or some transient post-battle blues. We hadn't even had a decent argument for months, and I wasn't giving Howard up the way he kept giving up cigarettes. I mean that I meant it. But do we ever know what we mean? Light years before, when I still believed we had made it for life like wolves, Howard left and went to live with another woman. After a while, he came back, and the children and I made room for him in the kitchen and the bedroom, ready to forgive, if not forget. I wish I could say that I had fallen in love this time, that I was rushing from the house with my skin on fire, and that Mr. Wonderful was going to roll me across the lawn and put out the flames. It wasn't like that, though. Howard and I were getting ready for bed, as we'd done for most of more than 24 years, moving through our old ballet of dropped shoes and emptied underwear. I realized that we didn't look frankly at one another's nakedness anymore. Waning interest made us glance away, and shyness of how we were changing. I guess Howard saw me the way I saw him, in hasty flashes of softened flesh before the lights went out.
Now, you wrote about these two characters in a 1977 novel called In the Flesh. Why did you bring them back for a new novel?
I didn't really bring them back. They just never left. They just kept living inside my head, and I always wondered what happened to them. And the way to find out was to write about them.
Now, shortly after the woman main character, Paulie, decides to leave her husband, he has a heart attack, and she
very inconvenient.
Yes. Well, she goes to see him in the hospital. And the next day she says, last night I'd left the hospital with fear and with the weight of love and love's history. And I think in a way that's the real subject of your book, the weight of love and the weight of love's history.
I think it is too. I think that when people are connected and share a history, they, Even when they separate, they can't quite separate. There's always something going on between them. History becomes a palpable thing. And they were deeply in love, as they keep telling you in alternating voices. They were very much in love.
In your new novel, the point of view alternates between the husband and the wife.
Yeah, that's new for me. That in the Flesh, in the original novel, it was all told through Paulie's point of view, and I finally decided that wasn't giving Howard his fair shake.
Yeah, now that really interests me, because I think that many women novelists really side with their woman protagonist and really see things from her point of view, especially in relationships.
And well, of course, and I'm very sympathetic with Paulie. There's no question about it. But I also see Howard as a real sympathetic whole person, too. And I felt if he didn't tell his side of the story, then it wasn't fair. I think that in the end, my greatest sympathy is with her. She is the wronged party in this marriage, so to speak. But I like him, too. And I grew to like him more as I began to let the story be told, and partly in his voice. I sort of understood his motives for what he did.
I guess that's a good exercise in trying to understand your character, to tell the story from their point of view.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun, too, to have your character not sound like a woman when it's meant to be a man. It was a big challenge.
Well, what did you have to do differently in terms of tone and...
Well, I always read my work aloud while I'm writing it, and if it begins to sound too much like me, I stop.
Now, you didn't start publishing until you were 35 years old. That was in 1965. Right. You published a short story?
My first short story in the old Saturday Evening Post, and I am really a late bloomer. And my first novel was published when I was 44.
And until then, you were...
A housewife.
I hate that word. I hate homemaker also. There's something so...
Domestic engineer, even worse.
It reminds me of those junior high school classes in homemaking that the girls had to take.
And I failed at that anyway. when Ending first came out, when the first book was published, I got a great deal of press in the local papers on Long Island. And the headlines read things like, Housewife Turns Into Writer. And I had this vision of a woman going into a telephone booth, tearing off her apron, and coming out with a big W on her chest. And it wasn't like that. It was very gradual. First of all, I had no role model, and I didn't know any writers in those days, and I just started writing and was lucky enough to have things published. And it just kept going, and finally I found myself just so involved in it that I stopped making Jell-O.
Well, how did you start writing? What made you decide to pick up the pen?
I sat down one day and just wrote a short story, and I was really lucky. Through a series of coincidences, I was able to contact an agent, and the agent took me on, and she had faith in the story, and it was eventually sold, and I bought my first car with the sale of that story. So
wow.
My life changed in material ways immediately. And I had written that story in about 2 hours, and I got enough money to pay for half the car at least. And I thought, wow, I'm going to write a story a week or a story a month. And you know, I saw myself with a fleet of Ramblers, but it didn't work out that way. I didn't sell another story for 3 years, and then it was to a small, prestigious literary magazine called New American Review, and I got $125 for it, and I was just as thrilled. So I knew I wasn't just in it for the money.
Were you worried when you started writing that you wouldn't have great themes because you had spent your adult life living in the suburbs?
Well, I've had to overcome that. I still worry about that, but I still claim that everything that happens in the bedroom and the kitchen matters more than what happens in the boardroom and the White House.
Did the women's movement give you courage to make that change?
Without any question. The feminine mystique was a very strong influence in my life. It gave me permission, not just courage. It really gave me permission to think of myself as a writer rather than as just a housewife.
Was there any resistance from your husband?
Some, definitely. I think he'd admit that. And gradually that went away, too. Mm-hmm. In fact, he has become the chief cook and bottle washer.
It is interesting to me, though, that you are able to basically start a new life while keeping the life that you had. A lot of people, when they make a really big change in their life, like becoming a writer, aren't able to contain that change within their current life, and they end up with some kind of divorce or a big move, something like that.
Well, it was really hard. It was a lot of work. It was a balancing act, really. I was given a Guggenheim fellowship in 1976 when I was writing In the Flesh, and one of the things I did with the money was hire a housekeeper part-time, who took some of those duties away. And it was hard to relinquish them. When you do something all the time, like cooking and cleaning, you're proud of it. It's your job, and you want to do it well. I no longer want to do that part of the job. I just prefer writing.
Now, your daughter, Meg, started publishing when she was 22, I think, her first novel.
Well, she published a short story when she was 11.
Oh, gosh. Did you react to that with both pride and a little bit of jealousy because she started so young?
You can't be jealous of your children. You just can't be. It was sheer pride. I think I wish I, too, could have had an early start so that I could, you know, make lots of mistakes and look forward to a long future of writing. But these things happen when they happen.
Do you and your daughter talk much about writing, or do you read each other's manuscripts?
We do all that, and we gossip a great deal, and it's fun. It's really nice.
The opening inscription for your new novel, Silver, is a quote from jazz singer Helen Humes, who sang with the Count Basie Band for a while. I think that's probably what she's most famous for.
It's a great quote, isn't it?
Yeah, why don't you read it and tell us where she said it and why you used it?
Trying to remember where I saw it. It was in a book about jazz by Whitney Balliot. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the name of the book, and this is a Helen Humes quote. I've had a very happy life, and I wouldn't do it otherwise. I even got married once and survived.
What appealed to you about that?
Oh, the irony of it, the wit, and the courage of it.
Okay. Hilma Wolitzer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Hilma Wolitzer's latest novel, Silver, is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. A paperback edition is due out in August. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, today is the president's last day overseas. Are you reporting on his day in England?
His day in England and his dinner with the Queen. This is the end of what we hear has been a very successful trip for the president, and we'll listen to some European analysts take a look at his trip. We also have a good, solid, long piece on the Polish elections and some very interesting campaigning by the Solidarity Trade Union there. We'll take a look at student loans and at Kentucky basketball. This is, of course, the day after the Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, announced his intentions to quit, and we'll have letters.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you were wondering what Robin Williams would do on the big screen after Good Morning Vietnam, the answer is Dead Poets Society. The film is directed by Australian Peter Weir, who also made Witness, Gallipoli, and The Last Wave. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Dead Poets Society.
Critics frequently complain that Hollywood never wants to take risks, that we never see bold and exciting new movies because the studios always have their eye on the bottom line. I've long quibbled with my colleagues on this point for a simple reason. The people I know at the studios are eager risk-takers. They know risks often make money. Look at Rain Man or Field of Dreams. The trouble is, Hollywood has bad taste in risks. Take Dead Poets Society. I've been hearing about this risky, difficult screenplay for years. After a while, I was hearing how brave Robin Williams and plucky Peter Weir, the director, had decided to plunge ahead with it despite the odds, and how the fearless folk at Disney's Touchstone Pictures had courageously chosen to back them. The result? Basically, Goodbye, Mr. Chips goes all American. Dead Poets Society is the lean on me of a more innocent age, an age when conformism was a bigger classroom scourge than crack, and when a 50s prep school teacher like Mr. Keating, played by Robin Williams, didn't need to wield a baseball bat in order to raise administrative eyebrows. In fact, all he needed to do was teach Shakespeare like this.
Now, many of you have seen Shakespeare done very much like this. Oh, Titus, bring your friend hither. But if any of you have seen Mr. Marlon Brando, no, but Shakespeare can be different. France, Romans, countrymen, let me rest.
You can also imagine maybe John Wayne is Macbeth going, "Well, is this a dagger I see before me?"
You've just heard the only genuinely amusing scene in Dead Poets Society, and the only scene in which Williams is allowed to cut loose a little. Mostly the movie is about how he tries to unleash his class's creativity and freedom of spirit by getting them to do things like stand on their desks so they can see the world from a new perspective, or by getting them to march around the schoolyard so he can teach them they needn't always be in step. He even encourages them to form something called the Dead Poets Society, in which the kids sneak off campus to a local cave and read poetry to one another. The poetry in this movie, by the way, never gets much riskier than Longfellow. Williams himself is terribly constrained here. The movie isn't often funny, and his character is allowed to reveal very little of himself beyond his saintly eagerness to inspire. Many of the young actors are quite good, but the movie seems to be taking place in some kind of Neverland, half Norman Rockwell and half Eton, circa 1935. Dead Poets Society is actually set in America in 1959, but these kids never seem even slightly infected by rock and roll, by cars or television or big league sports. Allen Ginsberg is howling his verse only a few hundred miles away, and these boys are getting all excited over "O Captain, My Captain." The better students in the audience may well wonder when Williams will stop uplifting his pupils long enough to teach them something. And I suspect that anyone over 13 will soon find the movie's self-righteous piety and its relentlessly bland vision downright annoying. Is this movie risky because it's opening in the thick of the summer movie season? I don't see why. Dead Poets Society is so wet, who needs the beach?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Aaron Appelfeld escaped from a concentration camp when he was 8. After the war ended, he joined the Soviet Army, then ended up in Israel. Today he's one of Israel's leading writers, and his novels reflect on the Holocaust and its aftermath. On the next Fresh Air, Appelfeld discusses the loneliness of survival. Also, performance artist John O'Keefe does an excerpt of his one-man show, Shimmer. It's O'Keefe's remembrances of his childhood as a ward of the state in Iowa. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews If the River Was Whiskey, the new collection of short stories by T. Karagas and Boyle. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.